Meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. It's Thursday, February 22nd. Welcome to those of you here in the Belts Room in the Capitol and the folks on gavel to gavel. We have present at the moment myself, Senator Ellis, and Senator Hoffman here. Thank you for being here, and we expect Senator Davis at any moment. There were two items noticed, but I want to let folks know that we will not be taking up Senate Joint Resolution Number 2 by Senator Huggins. The House bill has come over, and at Senator Huggins' request, his bill will be set aside. So we plan to take up House Joint Resolution Number 8 first, and it's my intention, if the presentation and the testimony supports it, to go ahead and ignore the unofficial rule of the committee, and if there's support here today, to move the resolution on to the full Senate. Today. We usually take a couple of days to think about this, but I'm predicting that we may not need to think an extra day about this resolution and should be able to lend it good support. Following action, I hope, on HJR 8, excuse me, we will have a briefing on the issues surrounding identity theft, and we have three or four guests lined up on teleconference to get the committee thinking along identity theft issues. So those are the two items before us today. Representative Thomas, if you could go ahead and join us at the table. Representative Thomas is the sponsor of the resolution, and I just want to read the title for the record and for the folks on gavel to gavel. It's opposing the enactment of the Washington State Legislature of a bill proposing to impose a fee on the processing of shipping containers in the state of Washington because of the negative impact of the fee on the people and the economy of this state. So, Representative Thomas, thank you for being with us. If you could just identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. Senator Hoffman, my name is, for the record, Representative Bill Thomas. I represent District 5. I call it all the villages on the southeast Alaska here. Mm-hmm. I think the title pretty much summarizes what the whole resolution is about, but just for the record, we'll go and go through that. The Senate and Washington introduced Senate Bill 5207, which will, right now in its present language, will put about a $50 tax on 20-foot vans, and a $100 tax on a 40-foot van going out of Washington. And when those vans go back to Washington, they'll pay another $50 tax on the 20-footers and another $100 on the 40-foot vans. So it'd be a $200 increase on shipping of freight out of Seattle to Alaska. This represents pretty close to 10% of the cost of shipping increase in the freight. And I see in the paper somebody said it was 10% of the goods. I guess it's 10% increase in the freight, so it's still very substantial. It represents about $40 to $50 million increase in cost of hauling freight to Alaska. We presently represent 97% of the goods that come to Alaska come by container vans through the state of Washington. And in 2003, we were the fifth largest exporter from Washington using vans. And so our understanding is that the state of Washington was trying to hit the Chinese and Japanese vans, container vans coming in and out of there for their ports, and that we're the fifth trader, but I think we're kind of incidental. They think it's small money, but to me, you know, $40, $50 million is pretty substantial to the people in the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. In my district, they're primarily fishermen and processing facilities there, so that will have an increase in moving the freight there. For the interior of Alaska, moving of fuel by drums will increase the cost of delivering fuel also. We've had a close economic relationship with the state of Washington for well over 100 years, since the Klondike days. We have about indirect, about 103,500 jobs that Alaska kind of, we take credit for in Washington, and about $4 billion worth of sales and product that we take out of it, and earnings and labor earnings too. So we're a big economic factor for that state. So what we want to do with the HJR 8 is let them know that we're aware of what they're doing. We can't intercept now in the Senate. They have a different system. The bill is only heard once for public testimony, then it goes in the executive committee, and then can be moved out. So we're hoping to get this through, and then if they have a hearing, if they move it forward, they may not, because it's been pretty, this has been getting a lot of press, and I think they're trying to reestablish as to what they want to do. But in case it does move out, we want to make sure that we're there on the House side in Washington opposing this. When this does get passed, we will send it to every member of the legislature, both in the House and the Senate in Washington, and the governor, let them know that we are watching. And with that, I want to compliment you for your comments, too, in the article.
Oh. Thank you very much.
That's good.
Some people thought I got carried away.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
They didn't quote mine, because I think mine was a little further.
When I said, don't sleep the waking giant, I meant Alaska, but I could have been referring to you, Representative Thomas. So.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to note for the record that Senator Betty Davis has joined the committee. Good afternoon. Any comments or questions for Mr. Thomas, Representative Thomas? If not, I think you have an important meeting that you need to go to, and Casey's going to fill in for you.
Yes.
If needed.
Any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much for your leadership on this issue. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator. Yep.
Let me turn to the teleconference now for a person to testify, Everett Billingsley. Mr. Billingsley, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
If you could state your name again and your affiliation for the record, and please go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Everett Billingsley, and I'm here on behalf of the Linden Company, Alaska Marine Lines, Linden Transport, and others.
Welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Linden is strongly in support of HDR 8, and we're very, very pleased for the opportunity to testify today. We're also working actively in the Washington legislature to try to oppose the underlying container fee bill that's the root of all the trouble. The Washington tax would be $50 per 20-foot equivalent unit, as Representative Thomas said. That's a TEU, which equates to $100 for a typical 40-foot container or $132.50 on the 53-foot equipment that Alaska Marine Lines uses. That's each way. The tax was not aimed at Alaska, but the goal of the tax was to tax the large container lines bringing massive quantities of cargo from Asia that use so much of the infrastructure in Washington to move through to the rest of the lower 48. And that's what the Washington legislature is looking for, money to improve that infrastructure. The impact on Alaska was an unintended consequence. Because most containers return from Alaska empty, the tax is effectively double, which would make it $265 on your typical AML container. And because the vast majority of goods that go to Alaska are shipped to Washington ports, and we have very few alternatives in Alaska, there's a disproportionate impact on the state, unlike the lower 48 where goods come from many areas. So the legislature and the governor in Washington need educating, and they're getting that with the press we've had recently and the letter from Governor Palin and HDR 8. That accomplishes that goal. It really sends a message that's very loud and clear to the Washingtonians. Last year, Linden Transport and AML together moved approximately 124,000 TEUs between Alaska and Washington. That would have meant more than $6.2 million in additional costs for our customers, and our customers are the Alaska shipping public. That would amount to approximately a 10% rate increase, depending upon the commodity and the destination. One other point, the sponsor of this bill, as mentioned, is trying to coordinate the bill with another bill in California. So we need to start keeping an eye on California and hopefully involve the Hawaiians in the effort. The impact on Hawaii if California makes a similar bill will be as bad as it is on Alaska. Last year, that bill did pass the California legislature, but Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it, and he may not be able to do that again. So Linden is strongly in support of SGR 8, and thank you for your time and letting me testify.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here, Mr. Billingsley. Are there comments or questions for the witness? If not, thank you again. Is there anyone here in the Belts room who would like to testify on the resolution? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on HJR 8. Like I said, we now have, for the record, a quorum established to do business on the resolution. No one has submitted any markup, any amendments for the resolution. I would note that there is a zero fiscal note that accompanies the resolution onto the floor. And I stated at the outset, Senator Davis, that if there's unanimity on the committee, if there's good support, that we probably don't have to hold this over for a later time. So that's our unofficial committee rule to take time to think about important legislation. But if there's support today, I'm happy to entertain a motion to move the bill.
Well, I'd be glad to move it. And is that CSPA House Joint Resolution 8, number 8?
Correct.
Move it out of committee with individual recommendation. A zero fiscal note.
And the accompanying fiscal note, yes. Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any objection, any discussion of the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? If not, so ordered. Thank you very much. Let's move. We need committee signatures. Thank you all for being here. Casey, that was pretty easy. You did a good job. Thank you very much. We're going to move quickly on to some folks who want to brief us on issues surrounding identity theft. We have four folks, and we're going to ask them to limit their testimony, and we will be having folks back before us if this issue continues. First is Mr. Ed Sniffen of the Department of Law. Mr. Sniffen, are you there?
Yes, I am, Senator. Thank you.
Can you go ahead with identify yourself and affiliation for the record, and let us know if this continues to be a problem in the state of Alaska.
Thank you. My name is Ed Sniffen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Civil Division of the Department of Law, and my responsibilities include the enforcement of Alaska's consumer protection and antitrust statutes. I was asked to give some information about identity theft and how our office deals with these issues and to let you know what some of those issues are. Identity theft in Alaska is primarily prosecuted under our criminal statutes. There are also federal statutes that make it a crime, but if there are ID thieves actually in Alaska that we happen to catch, we send them to the criminal division for prosecution under criminal laws, and hopefully they go to jail. Unfortunately, in Alaska, we don't have too many of those. What we have here are a lot of victims who are preyed upon by folks outside of Alaska. They are thieves in other states who are getting personal information from Alaskans and then committing these things. And it's difficult for us to go outside of our borders to catch and prosecute these things. So I think the Criminal Division and our office, we refer a lot of consumers to the Federal Trade Commission, which is the federal authority with the primary responsibility for monitoring and prosecuting these things on a national level. In Alaska, identity theft was again reported as the number one reported consumer fraud to the Federal Trade Commission in 2006. And there were an alarming number of people who were victims of identity theft. So it is a continuing problem here in Alaska, and it's going to get, I think, if not stay as bad as it is, get worse. There is some room for the state to think about ways that we can either make it easier for victims to undo the damage that's been done to them and also make it more difficult for identity thieves to get a hold of the types of personal information they need to have to commit this crime. And it's a difficult issue, and I know the federal legislators, our Congress has been dealing with some proposed national identity theft legislation, and it hasn't made a lot of progress, but we're hopeful that it's going to go forward. Other states have enacted some legislation aimed at stopping the dissemination of personal information. And that is one approach to trying to curb the abuses, and that is to make sure personal information isn't available to people who don't need to have it. And that's a double-edged sword because you need to have a way of identifying people. And historically, our Social Security numbers have been used for that. We need that for Medicare claims. We need to have it for payroll taxes. We need to have our Social Security number for a lot of things. And we've had to have used that number for decades. So it's really ingrained in our system. And targeting that piece of information as something that should be protected and not allowed to be disclosed is probably a good start. But you're going to have perhaps another number if it's not a Social Security number that folks will use, and if that number is compromised, you're going to have the same problem. So there are a number of of issues relating to the protection of personal information that can get a little tricky, but I think they're helpful. And the way that we're going to make some progress towards stopping identity theft is to guard our personal information, and then on the flip side, perhaps help victims by making it a little easier for them to repair their credit reports, for example, and be declared, you know, innocent of these crimes so they can get their lives back and move on. And we have heard a number of horror stories from consumers who will tell you that it's the worst thing that's ever happened to them in their lives, being the victim of identity theft. It's very, very complicated and difficult to undo. So I think efforts on that front would be helpful as well. And I don't want to take up too much more time. I'd be happy to answer any questions folks have of our office about identity theft and the efforts that we have made recently to educate the public about identity theft issues to make sure people are aware that it's very, very important to protect your personal information. So with that, Senator Ellis, I will end my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sniffen. We appreciate you being with us, and I excuse me, have personally appreciated over the years your commitment to consumer protection in the Department of Law. And I know that's been an underfunded pursuit, but I've appreciated you being there.
Well, thank you.
Are there comments or questions from members of the committee for Mr. Sniffen? Mr. Sniffen, can you just tell us, have you followed the case in state? You know, we see in the media all the time national reports all across the country of terrible identity theft situations, and I know there was the big, a relatively large identity theft ring there in the interior around North Pole. Do you know how that's all turned out for the victims and for the perpetrators?
Senator Ellis, I have to admit I am aware of that, but I don't know how that's turned out. I know that there are continuing efforts to try and help those folks, and there may be other folks here who know a little more about that effort, but I have to apologize. I'm not familiar with the details.
Okay. And did I hear you correctly that there is federal legislation, but it's not making good progress? I'm sure it's an even more complicated situation in Congress than with the issues.
Yes, Senator. I know that Senator Stevens had contemplated putting some legislation together that I actually had worked on for a little bit last year. And I don't know if it didn't get the support it needed, but there have been various attempts by different congressmen to get some type of federal identity theft, so to speak, legislation together, and they're having some difficulty with that for a variety of reasons, I understand. But I suspect that in the next couple years we might see a proposal from Congress.
Okay. Any other comments or questions, Mr. Sniffen? If you could stand by, I may have a couple of questions later, but I want to move now to Gail Hillebrand of the Consumers Union. Gail, are you there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Gail Hillebrand, Consumers Union. You may know us as a nonprofit publisher of Consumer Reports. Our mission is to test, inform, and protect, and I'm with the Protect, part of our organization. I'd like to share with you a little bit of information about the scope and cost of identity theft, to identify the two major types, and to talk about three approaches in the legislation before you that will help to reduce, although not entirely stamp out, identity theft. Identity theft is a significant factor in the financial lives of Americans. Depending on which study you look at, between 8.4 million and 10 million Americans become victimized by this crime every year. That's 16 to 19 new victims every minute in America. The federal government estimates the cost to business and consumers at $52 billion a year, and there are more recent industry studies saying it's about $49 billion a year. And that doesn't count the family stress and the social costs. And there are increasingly reports coming out of Oregon, Washington, and Alberta, Canada, of a link between identity theft and methamphetamine use. The two main types of identity theft are new account fraud. This accounts for about 30% of identity theft, but it's the most difficult kind to discover and to unravel and can have the most difficult consequences on individuals. It takes about three times longer to discover new account fraud and about twice as many hours for the consumer to fix that. New account fraud involves a real consumer's name, a real Social Security number, and a fake address or the thief's address. It's facilitated by a stolen Social Security number or a compromised Social Security number, and the way in which the credit reporting system will okay people as good credit risk based on essentially just a name and the Social Security number. The other type of identity theft is existing account identity theft, sometimes called account takeover. This can range from a simple unauthorized charge on your credit card all the way up to a stolen debit card number and even draining of bank accounts. There are three approaches that can help to reduce these forms of identity theft. The first two are directed to the Social Security number issue and new account fraud, that most dangerous kind of identity theft. Once a Social Security number has been stolen, one approach that many states are taking, 26 so far, is to make it harder to turn that stolen Social Security number into cash through the so-called security freeze. The security freeze doesn't stop the stealing of your SSN, but it does stop the issuance of new credit or new cell phone, other kinds of accounts for goods and services based on someone pretending to be you using that SSN in the credit system. I know you looked at this measure last year, and you may all be very familiar with it. The idea of the security freeze is that if the Social Security number is the financial front door for individual constituents, the security freeze is a deadbolt. The individual can choose to put that extra security on their file. The credit, you ask for it affirmatively. The credit bureau gives you a PIN or password, and then you have to open that extra lock if you're the one who wants to use your own credit. 26 states have done that so far. It's an important self-help tool for consumers who want to stop the opening of new accounts in their name even before it happens. The second major area for reducing new account identity theft is to reduce the proliferation of Social Security numbers in records of all kinds, private and public. The measures that are before you, Article 4 in particular of those measures, has reduction in the collection of SSNs. That's an important new step. You'd be one of the first states to do that. It also has provisions that do many of the things we've been recommending to get the Social Security number out of the mailbox, out of the wallet by not having it printed on cards that you need for services, off the Internet, out of the marketplace for sale, and out of the trash can. And that's Article 5 of some of the measures that have been introduced this year, making sure it's properly disposed of. Finally, in addition to reducing the collection and sale of SSNs, we think it's important that when sensitive information is compromised, your constituents have a chance to find out about it. And that's Social Security numbers, driver's license, account numbers, and PINs and passwords. One thing we've learned in the last few years is no matter how careful you are with your own personal mail and your own personal records, your information can be stolen from someone else. And Article 1 of many of the measures that were introduced would give constituents notice that there's been a breach. When constituents learn there's been a breach, they can do a few things to help protect themselves. They can choose to place the freeze. They can choose to exercise some federal rights that are not as strong as the freeze but are available now. They may choose to change their PINs or account numbers, depending on what was taken. And they can choose to read their statements more carefully, because the sooner identity theft is discovered, the better chance you have of stamping it out with less time and less headache. These steps won't stamp out identity theft altogether, but the security freeze would give every Alaskan a choice and a new form of self-defense against new account fraud. And the Social Security protections would reduce the number of places where this valuable information can be taken by thieves and used to abuse your citizens. We appreciate your interest in this area and would like to help you in any way that we can.
Ms. Hillebrand, thank you for your time today. I want to be clear, there's no specific legislation before us at this time, but we wanted to put on the record some information and prepare the committee for some of the issues surrounding identity theft. And there is legislation moving its way through the system. So I'm sure we will have you back at a later time to dig more specifically into these issues. But I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. First, about government versus the private sector. In your experience across the nation, I've heard of identity breaches based on government giving out information or government being the source of information about an individual's identity that's used for nefarious purposes, as well as the private sector being a place where information can be obtained to hurt an individual's credit and bank account. Do you track that or know? Is it your sense that both the public and private sectors are sources of this information to the bad guys? And do you have any sense of the proportion of that?
Yes, both our sources, also universities, both public and private, have been a weak link in the chain. The Privacy Rights Clearinghouse at privacyrights.org maintains a running list. They have a summary of each of the breaches over the last 2 years that has resulted in about 109 million records being compromised. The two largest ones, one was the Veterans Administration, of course, at 26 million records, but the other was card systems, which was 40 million credit and debit card numbers. We're seeing the problem coming both from government and from private.
So is it the Consumers Union recommendation that any legislation that were to be worked on address both facets, both holding government accountable as well as the private folks?
Yes, we do recommend that, particularly with respect to notice of breach and with respect to this question of when can you ask for an FSN and when should it something else be used instead, that those standards be looked at both for government and for private entities.
Okay, thank you. And I guess this discussion or debate's going on in legislatures across the country, and we heard Ed talk about the debate in Congress. And, you know, different approaches get floated out there and language that's touted as the, you know, the perfect solution or a great solution to things. Are there any kind of approaches that are kind of dead ends or that sound good intuitively or on their face but may not really in reality solve the problem?
Yes. When you look at the notice of breach issue around the country, some folks are coming into state legislatures and coming into Congress and saying, don't require notice until it's known that the breach caused harm. And the problem with that approach is that in most cases, when there's a breach, in a timely fashion, no one's going to know what the risk of harm is. All you're going to know is the data is missing, and maybe it's lost, and maybe it's stolen, or it has been stolen, but we don't know by who, and we don't know if they stole it for the hardware or for the information value of the data. If in every circumstance where the information is incomplete, consumers don't get any notice of breach will be ineffective. And we are seeing that debate raging in state houses and full policy raging in Congress, is what do you do when there's not enough information? And what we've recommended is tell the consumer, so that they can make their own choice about how carefully to watch their records and files.
Okay. Ms. Hillebrand, I guess it was a provision in California's identity theft law passed a couple of years ago that let a number of Alaskans know that they had been the subject of ID theft from a private clearinghouse of information, and I think that was what got some of us interested here in Alaska in the issue after those Alaskans received the notification because of the California law. So if you had a hand in that, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ms. Hillebrand, we will have you back, and we appreciate your time today. We're pressed for time here in the committee, so I'm going to call on Pat Luby and Ann Sinkrest from AARP. We'll finish up with Steve Clary from ACPIRG, but if you guys could be as brief and to the point as possible, and I promise we will have you back when legislation is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Pat? Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. I think the one point I would add to the information that you already are very familiar with is that when an older victim suffers from identity theft, there's been research and evidence that shows that it's not just the psychological stress, but physically there's a lot of stress involved in this. And we actually have found that older people who've been victims of identity theft have a higher mortality rate than older people who have not been victims. So for AARP members, this is certainly not just a pocketbook issue. It's a serious issue to their health and well-being. The surveys that we've done of all our members indicate that identity theft is one of their top concerns. It's a growing concern every year as we do more surveys. It's a devastating crime, certainly for anyone, but it certainly seems to hurt physically and psychologically and economically older people much more than others. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Pat, for being with us. Ann, did you have something to add?
Yes, if I could. Thank you, Senator. Very briefly, as you know, identity theft is the fastest growing crime in the U.S., and we did, as Pat alluded to, we did survey our members in October 2002, and identity theft is certainly a big component of consumer fraud. In October 2002, 36% of the respondents said they were extremely concerned about consumer fraud. Now, we just received the results of a survey that was conducted in October of 2006, and in that survey, 47% said that issue should be given top legislative priority, and 30% said it should be given a high priority. So that's a total of 77% who saw it as high or top priority. Contrast that again with 36% back in 2002. So it is on the radar. From a perspective of being on the front line, we have joined forces, AARP did, with the State of Alaska Division of Banking and Securities to do statewide campaign. It's called the Alaska Campaign for Safe and Wise Investing. And we're doing 13 different workshops. And we've done 5 so far, Anchorage, Sitka, Ketchikan, Palmer, Wasilla, and Juneau. And I can tell you, in the consumer fraud area, those sessions are well attended. People are extremely concerned, and often you walk away hearing some stories from individuals who never thought they would be a victim. And the one thing, too, that Pat, I'm going to spring off from what Pat said, ID thieves are equal opportunity thieves. Doesn't matter the age. It's certainly a concern for AARP members, but when this happens to individuals who are AARP members, it does affect the entire family. And ID thieves don't necessarily target. They're going to target anyone who's vulnerable. And once they get on that mooch list, I mean, that's a list that is bought and sold between thieves. So we're out there trying to teach everything from identity theft, how to protect your credit, predatory lending practices, investment fraud. And in each case, in each workshop, we hear stories. We're on to Bethel on March 8th and 9th, and then we'll be in Kenai, Soldotna, Kodiak, Fairbanks, Barrow, and Nome. And I can guarantee that when we're done with this campaign at the end of April, we'll be able to write a book on all the different cases on identity theft. Thank you.
Ms. Sechrest, thank you for being with us. Mr. Luby, some of the saddest stories we hear are from senior citizens and folks who thought having a shredder was all they needed to do, and that's not the case. So thank you for being with us. And after you go on your trip with your presentations, if there's information you can provide to the committee in written form to establish the record for the need for legislation, please let us know. Let's move on quickly to Steve Cleary. I know Senator Hoffman has to go to an important meeting, but Steve, if you're there, please go ahead, and then we're going to wind up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. This is Steve Cleary. I'm Executive Director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, ACPIRG, and we're a member organization based here in Alaska dedicated to consumer protection. So I'm happy to be here today to talk about this important topic of identity theft. And I did submit some written testimony, so I'll just go over the highlights of that. But at ACPIRG, we, like the AARP, are committed to teaching our members and to teaching Alaskans how to be better consumers and how to protect their personal information. But we also believe it's critical that education is also followed up with strong consumer protection legislation. And so we're hopeful that will come out in this session. Perhaps some of the earlier speakers have gone over the Federal Trade Commission data, but in 2005, Alaska was number one in fraud complaints. And the good news on that front is in 2006, we're down to number five with about 500 less complaints. But the sad news is that those people who did take the time to file with the FTC paid an average of $3,847, which was up quite a bit from what was paid in 2005, which is more in the range of $1,000. So that total is about $3.5 million coming from Alaskan consumers, and we know that businesses get quite a bit of money stolen from them as well through identity theft. In my testimony that I emailed to you all, there's a Javelin Better Business Bureau survey conducted in January of 2006, which shows, similar to the Alaska figures, that identity fraud is decreasing just only slightly in the frequency, but also is really increasing in the amount of money that it's taking from consumers and also the time that it's taking from consumers. And we heard from Pat Luby of the AARP the emotional toll that that takes. Estimates I've seen put it at anywhere from 40 to 175 hours that it takes a consumer to get back their good name and their credit. And as we see increasingly, a consumer's credit report reaches into many aspects of life, including employment insurance, as well as further credit and loans. And another identity theft story that I like to highlight came out last year. A woman in Juneau contacted our office. She was actually working for the state government at the time and was on maternity leave when identity thieves, one of her neighbors actually, stole her identity. And it really became a headache for them when their child was born, and trying to figure out social security numbers and everything at, you know, for their own sake at that time, but also the stress of having to deal with that while they were having a child, and the headaches that caused is really hard to put a price on. So we're very happy to see the legislature moving on to take steps to, as Ms. Hillebrand said, from Consumers Union, to make sure that there is a mandatory notification when a security breach happens, and also to give consumers the choice to be able to freeze their credit report to protect from further damage from identity theft. And that's really, I think, the point that we want to see in the bills is, or in any further legislation, is that consumers have the choice to freeze their credit report so that they can take control and make sure that identity thieves aren't preying on them, and they can take the steps to regain their good name. Again, thank you for the opportunity to participate today, and I look forward to further conversations in the future and some good legislation.
Mr. Clary, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it. The intent today was to establish a record here in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee of the problem out there across the country and in the state, and the need for identity theft legislation. So this discussion will continue. Appreciate you being here, Senator Davis, and the folks who participated here today. The conversation will continue. Is there any? If there's no further business to come before the committee? Nope. My trusty staffer says no for today. We'll adjourn the meeting at 2:16 in the afternoon.